The Tom Woods Show, episode 1498.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you have a website, don't let it be a lazy bum. Make that website carry its own weight. Monetize that baby. I've got a free over-the-shoulder video where I show you about a half dozen ways that I do that on my sites. Check it out at tomwoods.com/monetize. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. You know, every once in a while, you just have to do a basic episode on a basic topic just to revisit it, partly for the new folks who are just coming into this and partly for the oldsters like me who haven't thought about these basic things in a while. And maybe we've lost the sharpness of our arguments or we've forgotten some of the details. And leave it to Bernie Sanders to inspire me on a topic like this. You know, a lot of people say about Bernie Sanders doesn't understand basic economics. And I just don't necessarily feel that way. I feel like, well, it's not that he doesn't understand it, it's he just doesn't care about it. It's that whatever the economists tell him, his point is his desires override what the economists tell him. So if they say this is going to slow down growth or whatever, he'll say, fine, I'd rather have slightly slower growth and more justice in the world. You know, so what economics has to tell him is not of interest to him, given his scale of values. Now, that goes to a point, I suppose. I mean, if we were to say, look, your employment strategy is going to disemploy hundreds of millions, then he would probably have to listen, or at least he'd have to make up an even more grandiose excuse for why that doesn't matter. But my point is, it's not really a matter of he picked up a textbook on economics and it all went over his head. It's more a matter of, it would be like me saying the progress we've seen since the Industrial Revolution in the improvement of the standard of living of the average person has come about through capital accumulation rather than through legislation. And even if I were to persuade Bernie of this, his answer would be, that may be, but we have people in the here and now who need help. And yeah, maybe if we have further capital accumulation, that may eventually help them. But I'd like to help them right now. And that would be the way he would look at it. It wouldn't necessarily have to be that he would totally disregard everything we're saying. It would be, all right, I hear you, but what do I do about this guy right here and now? Right here and now, I want to raise taxes to help this particular person. Your strategy doesn't do that, he'll say. Your strategy helps us with a bunch of anonymous people in the future. I want to help this particular person in the present. So I think that's where he's coming from. And I think that's wrong, too. I think it's the wrong way to look at it. But I think that's where he's coming from. Now, having said all that, I heard him talk about rent control the other day, and here he clearly doesn't understand economics. I mean, that really is what's happening here. That really, really is what's happening here. He made a statement along the lines of, we cannot allow landlords to set rents arbitrarily because this is unjust and people will suffer. So we need to have national rent control, not just in particular cities or states, but national rent control, as if there haven't been experiences with this already. And this is one of these areas of economics where pretty much all economists agree. Free trade is an area where all economists agree. Up till recently, the minimum wage was an area where all economists agree. Like, it didn't matter what their partisan affiliation was. All economists agreed on those things. But another one of those things has been rent control, as a matter of fact. And when, for example, Walter Block is an economist many of you listening will know from Loyola University New Orleans, been a guest on this podcast a number of times, and Walter has done, in fact, I think Walter may even have done his PhD dissertation on rent control, as a matter of fact. But he also did a survey of economists. Now, you'll forgive me, I don't recall exactly the year in which he did it, but he found that fewer than 5% of economists disagreed with the statement that a ceiling on rents reduces the quantity and quality of housing available. So basically, all economists agree with that. So for Bernie to take this position really is flying directly in the face of economics as we know it. So what I thought I'd do here is run through a bit of the argument as to what's wrong with this, because it seems on a superficial level, if you are a left progressive, that while that is what we should do, if rents are too high, well, doggone it, we pass a law, we make them lower. And you think, well, that's going to work because I can see that the rents get lower. That really does happen. You know, the minimum wage, I really do see people's wages go up. So what's the problem? Well, there are numerous problems. And I'd like to start, actually, by running through the arguments in, of all things, Economics in One Lesson. That really is how elementary this is. Economics in One Lesson, 1946, the classic work by Henry Hazlitt, who, by the way, held no degree in economics. I believe Henry Hazlitt was a high school graduate, if even that. That was as far as he went. He didn't do college. And yet he wrote so brilliantly in so many areas. And that book sold millions of copies. And as a nonfiction author myself, I can assure you, millions of copies is not what most books can say for themselves. Okay, almost nothing sells millions of copies. New York Times bestsellers do not sell millions of copies in general. Anyway, Economics in One Lesson begins with the one lesson. And I bet a lot of you listening know what the one lesson is. The one lesson is that if you want to evaluate the wisdom of some economic proposal, don't look simply at its immediate consequences for one particular targeted group. Look at the long-term consequences for everybody. And Hazlitt then proceeds to apply this lesson to various topics, various areas. And the one criticism you might make of Economics in One Lesson is that some of the topics raised are really kind of dated now. They're good to read because they help sharpen your abilities as an economist to work through them. But a lot of them, they're either arguments people don't make anymore or they're policies that really don't exist. I wouldn't say the book is not useful, but it's a little bit less useful than it used to be. And one of the reasons I used to think it's not useful is that nobody in his right mind favors rent control anymore. Because even the left, you can't reason with them from theory, but when they look at the actual results, they say, all right, well, I guess that didn't work. So nobody favors rent control. So I thought, well, it's another way that Hazlitt's a little bit behind the times. Well, you know, you just wait long enough and somebody comes on back favoring it again. So let's see what the actual consequences are. Now, we can also talk about the justice of the question. And that is not a small matter. If you are the owner of an apartment building, you haven't done anything wrong. The only crime you've committed is to build low-cost housing for people. Like, that's the only crime you've committed. And if suddenly you're told what kinds of voluntary agreements you can make with other people, well, that is obviously a violation of your property rights because you can't dispose of that property as you wish. But then there's the other question. This is a question that comes up that I've brought up in the context of the living wage or the family wage. And these days they're just calling it Fight for 15. And I think about, you know, let's say the case of McDonald's, fast food places. That's the classic place we think of when we think of a place where it would be nice for people to get paid more. Okay. I personally think they'll get paid whatever makes sense for them to get paid. But there are a lot of people who think they need to get paid more at McDonald's. And what we get are these proposals for $15 an hour. And the kind of argument that I've made is, why should it be, well, here we have these people who are poor. These are the working poor. Why should it be that the entire burden of helping these people should be placed on the shoulders of their employer? Why wouldn't we, not that I favor either position, but why wouldn't we just socialize that across society? Why wouldn't we all chip in? Why would we place the entire burden of helping these people on the employer, ordering him to pay them more, as opposed to all of us helping out the working poor? The employer is, in fact, literally the only person on earth doing a thing to help these people. And yet that's the person on whom the entire burden rests. And I sometimes give the example of, what about all those people who didn't hire our suffering worker in the first place? And so those people pay the person zero. Why do they get completely off the hook? That makes no sense. So instead, why don't we just say that this is society's obligation? Well, likewise for rent control. Why should the entire burden of easing the material difficulties of the average person who struggles with rent fall on the shoulders of the owners of the apartment building who actually went to the trouble of providing housing for these people? Why wouldn't we all together say, we'll all pitch in to get these people housing? The same way we do with food, notice. We don't say that the grocery stores now have to lower their prices by 50% in order to accommodate the poor. We don't do it that way. We don't do a lot of things that way. But for some reason, we do this with rent control. And my point is just simply, it's never explained why the burden should fall entirely on this one sector of society. What is the justification for this? All right. Well, what else are problems with rent control? Well, the key one, of course, is that if rents can't move up, then you're not going to have as much housing built in the first place, because there are many different investments somebody could make. And do you think you're going to make an investment in something where the government is controlling the price? Obviously not. You'll invest in something else, so you're going to make the housing shortage, so-called, even worse. I mean, this should be obvious. People just won't expand. Or the current owners of apartment buildings, who often are the ones most likely to build still more apartment buildings, they won't do it because, for one thing, they don't have the money. Because as time goes on, the rent control continues and the divergence between costs and revenues grows ever wider. Where are they going to get the capital from? So they might not have the capital and they might not want to do it, as they see what results from rent control, which is, for example, a low-intensity civil war between the tenants and the landlord. The landlord is ticked off that these people are obviously taking advantage of him, and the state is taking advantage of him. And so the tenants will make requests of him that any tenant might make of a landlord, like, please fix this, please straighten that up. But he figures, why should I bother? At rents this low, I could get anybody in the world to come take that apartment, even in the shabby condition it's in now. So why should I bother? What possible incentive do I have to keep these people happy? These SOBs deserve what they get, becomes the attitude. And so instead of there being some kind of fellow feeling between the two sides, there's nothing but antagonism. You want me to build more of these? I don't think so. I don't think I'm going to do that. Now, by the way, that is about the general argument against rent control, but there's more that can be said about it. I want to throw in a few more considerations. But before we do that, I want to continue to pursue you aggressively on the issue of improving your mental health and helping you more easily cope with the various problems that confront us in life with specific solutions. And a very effective way to do that is with the Simple Habit app. And this may be something that you've never imagined yourself doing. Meditating? Come on, that's woo-woo. Other people do that. But those other people also happen to have maybe better mental health. Maybe they have a better handle on things. Maybe they're more at peace. So maybe it's worth thinking about. Simple Habit has short meditations you can consume in just 5 minutes. And you can consume them while you're on the go and doing other things. So just because you're busy does not mean you can't do this. Simple Habit has over 65,000 five-star reviews. And incidentally, you got hundreds of meditations available for free with Simple Habit and thousands with the premium subscription. Well, go to simplehabit.com/woods and take 30% off the premium subscription. That's right. My listeners can take 30% off the premium subscription when you go to simplehabit.com/woods. Now, it's also the case that rent control encourages wasteful use of space. This is one of Hazlitt's additional points. So, for instance, you've got a rent-controlled apartment. You know it's worth its weight in gold. You never, ever want to get rid of that thing. So an apartment that might have made sense when you had 5 kids doesn't make as much sense when you're empty nesters and you have no kids. But why would you give it up? It's still a great price, and you'll never get another apartment like that. So meanwhile, a family that really needs an apartment for 5 kids can't find it, because you're sitting in one that you don't need. And that, I mean, sometimes we enjoy having things that we don't strictly quote-unquote need. So I'm not saying that's a moral problem, but I am saying they're making that decision based on falsified prices. They would probably not make that decision if that rent were at a price that, you know, conformed to market conditions. So you're depriving another family of that apartment, but also the whole policy is depriving people of apartments, because again, who's going to expand the housing stock under these conditions? And then, of course, as Hazlitt says, what winds up happening is rent control fails. And then instead of saying, gee, maybe we shouldn't have intervened in the housing market, instead you get the opposite answer, which is we didn't intervene enough, obviously. Right? Every time we give the patient this medicine, he dies. So the only possible answer can be we haven't given enough medicine. That's the way politics makes people think for some reason. It's deranged. So they think instead, since we've proven that the private sector just won't build low-cost housing, we'll step in. and build low-cost housing directly, we the state. Now, incidentally, I did an episode some time ago with Ryan McMakin about how the state makes housing more expensive, so I'll try and remember. In fact, instead of remembering, I'm going to get a piece of paper right here, ready? Hear that? That's me, that's Wiz with the old piece of paper. And we're going to write down that I'm going to put the McMakin episode on how the state makes housing more expensive. So that's another aspect that doesn't directly have to do with rent control, but the resulting high prices become the excuse for rent control, even though the high prices are at least partly the fault of the state. So we're going to do that. Also, before I go on, remember, you can also read about this as one of the chapters in my book, AOC is Wrong. So if you don't have AOC is Wrong, I mean, that one's got to be a prized possession. AOC is Wrong. I mean, boy, if everyone deserved an intellectual beatdown, it's that woman. And so AOCiswrong.com is where you should go to get my free ebook on that. And there will be a section on housing. Now then I want to add a few more thoughts here because I was reading some Walter Block. And remember I said earlier on that the state of the economics profession is such that virtually all economists believe that rent control is a bad thing, right? Virtually all of them. And even socialist economists can be found to have said that. So for instance, Assar Lindbeck was a Swedish economist, and he said, in many cases, rent control appears to be the most efficient technique presently known to destroy a city, except for bombing. So how about that? So that's worth bearing in mind. Also, we find yet another source saying it is nearly impossible to find any respected economist or academic who is willing or able to defend rent controls. Now, Walter has an interesting point. Now, he reiterates the point that's made by Henry Hazlitt, which is that what often happens is when rent control is instituted, luxury apartments are exempted on the reasoning that rich people don't need rent control. If anybody who can afford to buy a luxury apartment is in a good enough position that that person doesn't need any state assistance. So no rent control for luxury apartments. So what do you think the result is? Less low-cost housing is built, fewer low-cost apartments are built, and more luxury apartments are built because there's no ceiling on those. So you have exactly the opposite of the outcome you would want if what you really wanted was to help the poor, which is why sometimes people think these people can't actually want to help the poor. I mean, come on. All right, it's possible some of them are just dumb and they don't get how this works. But come on, every single one of them? I mean, could they all be that dumb? And so you may have heard me tell this story before, but Morgan Reynolds, who served in the Labor Department under George W. Bush, was in the audience. Now, I've been friendly with him, so there's no hostility there. But he was in the audience when I gave a talk on economics and the church, and I was talking about, you know, these people just don't seem to get it. And he said, you know, I just, at this point in my career, I just no longer have any patience with these people just don't seem to get it, because this is not brain surgery here, right? This is, the basic logic of it is not difficult to grasp. These people advocate these policies knowing full well what the consequences are going to be, because they want to keep these people helpless and dependent on them, because that's their natural constituency. Whatever would they do without these people? To show up in droves to vote for them. Whatever would they do? They want to keep them there. They want these things to so-called fail so that they can then justify another round of state intervention. Now, I'm not quite sure if I'm that cynical, because I do think there are some politicians who genuinely are dumb enough that they could not follow the simple logic of this, that you control low-cost apartments, you don't control luxury apartments. What do you think is going to happen? I bet there are some people dumb enough not to be able to follow to the end of that line of reasoning. But all of them? Every single one is that dumb? Every one? Could it be that some of them are doing this on purpose? I mean, that's scary and sinister stuff. Anyway, so Walter makes that point, but he also says this. He says, and I'm going to read this whole thing to you, because I love how sometimes Walter comes up with examples and thought experiments that I would never have thought of. So he says, rent controls are so cumbersome a method of reducing housing costs for tenants that the very opposite tack might more nearly achieve this goal. Suppose there were a rational housing planner who wanted to lower rents and was limited to utilizing price controls. Would he adopt rent controls? Not a bit of it. Instead, he would go in the very opposite direction. Namely, he would control the prices of everything else except residential rental housing, food, clothing, transportation, pharmaceuticals, etc. Then, investment funds seeking higher uncontrolled profits would gravitate toward rental housing, the only free sector of the economy remaining under our assumptions. With all the resulting increase in supply, rents would come down. And now Walter says, this scenario is obviously hypothetical, it's never occurred, but we do have an illustrative experience. In addition to allowing exemptions for new housing, regulators often do the same for luxury units. And so investment in lavish accommodation increases and its price falls, while very few modest suites are built and their price tends to rise. So he says, if the urban planners had really had the interests of the poor at heart and had only the option of imposing price controls on housing, then they should have exempted lower class housing and controlled the luxury variety. Then investment funds would desert the latter and embrace the former. So in other words, the opposite of what they're doing would make the most sense. If all you have at your disposal is price controls, put the price controls. Now, I'm not advocating this, obviously. It's just a thought experiment to show how dumb these people are. And I hate using the words dumb and stupid. I really don't like doing this. I really don't. I mean, I like to think, well, their hearts are in the right place, but this really is stupid. Come on. Because think of the logic of it. If you put price controls on luxury apartments, you'll get fewer of those. And you have no price controls on lower cost apartments, you get way more of those. So just do the opposite of what these SOBs advocate, and you'll be a lot better off. Okay, the people who are supposed to be the great advocates for the poor, oh, man, the poor need to be rescued from them. All right, folks, that is our episode for today. Your homework assignment, if you have not completed it yet, is to go get your copy of AOC is Wrong. I mean, why are you going out spending money on books? I'm giving them to you for free over here. All right. Don't spend any money on books. Save money on books this month. You know, take your significant other out for dinner. Okay. With the money you save on books, go to AOCiswrong.com and get that thing. And you will be like the king of the world when you do that. So that's it for today, everybody. Tomorrow, what do I got coming up tomorrow? I think I got Paul Gottfried. That's always a goodie. A couple other good ones. Mark Clare from Lions of Liberty is coming on. I got interesting new documentary on the Trayvon Martin case. So we're going to talk about that. So I got some goodies coming up this week. Then next week, you're never going to believe it. Next week, it's Dave Smith week on this podcast. Ain't no way that's going to be a disappointment. That's going to be awesome. And we're all going to have fun that week. All right. So go subscribe to the show, tomwoods.com/apple. Cost you nothing. And make sure and get AOC is Wrong over at AOCiswrong.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.